KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Bayview.
Outer Sunset.
I live in Bernal Heights.
St. Francis Wood.
La Lengua.
Coal Valley.
Alemania Boulevard.
Coming up, El Nino's back. So how's all this rain affecting our water supply?
The vast majority of rainwater in cities flows right into storm drains and goes to the oceans.
What does this weather mean? Then, watch out, there's an apex predator among us.
If a coyote feels threatened, then they might attack. Whether a person come at them threatening or not, who knows how the coyote feel.
And we'll continue finding answers to your questions, like this one.
Why are there so many sand dollars on Ocean Beach? Are they doing okay, or have we poisoned the ocean and we're killing them off?
Find out today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. All right, it's official. El Nino has arrived. And even though this week we're finally seeing a string of sunny weather, it has been rainy. Reservoirs are filling up and our snowpack is way above average. But does this mean our state's chronic water troubles are almost over? And how is all that water affecting our water supply? KALW's environment reporter Angela Johnston joins me now for an update. Hey, Angela.
Hey.
So let's talk about this. I can't remember it raining this much in many, many years.
Right. It's been raining a lot. Get this. We've had 18 trillion gallons of rain.
Over what time?
Since February, in just 19 days.
What?
Yeah, 18 trillion gallons. That's the volume of Lake Tahoe.
Mm.
2019 has been off to a pretty big rainy start. Our water year is way above average. And last week, the National Weather Service Climate Prediction Center declared we are officially in an El Nino year.
Mm.
The last one was in 2016, and it was nicknamed Godzilla. So forecasters say this one won't be as strong, but we should see warmer ocean temperatures and, as a result, heavier periods of rainfall in the coming months.
They didn't make up a name for this one?
Not yet. And because El Nino means warmer temperatures along the coast, this year's El Nino may push the planet to its warmest year on record.
Okay, so how are the rainfall averages so far?
According to the National Weather Service, we are 121% above average, and we still have a few more months of winter weather.
Wow.
We need about another foot of rain before October if we want to reach a pretty historic 50-year average, and that could easily happen if we get another rainy week later this spring.
Mm-hmm.
Almost all the reservoirs in the state are more full than they normally are in pre-drought conditions.
Okay, what about the snowpack? Because I live in the East Bay, and we have been seeing snow up, you know, in Fremont, the Mission Hills area.
Yeah.
Mission Peak is snowy. That's crazy. My daughters were like, that's snow, Mama.
Yeah. I took a walk around the studio here at KLW last week, and I could see snow all over the East Bay foothills. I never see that.
Mm-hmm.
It's rare to get even a slight snowpack at these lower levels.
Yeah.
And if anyone's been skiing up in Tahoe recently, you'd be able to guess that the snowpack there is doing really well. All the resorts are doing really well.
Mm.
It's already 41% above average. So even if it didn't snow another inch this winter, we'd still have a lot of water stored in our snowpack. But places like Redding and the low Sierra foothills are also seeing way more snow than normal, and that's concerning for areas that aren't prepared to deal with all of it.
Mm-hmm.
The storm last week in Redding snarled traffic, knocked out power, and closed a bunch of schools.
Right. It's not all good news. What about the areas that were affected by fires this past year? How's the rain impacting those places?
Well, there's always a risk for mudslides when there's a lot of rain in a region that's been burned. There aren't any reports of mudslides are flooding this year in the Northern California region scorched by fires. But there have been mudslides in places without fires.
Mm.
On Monday, Sausalito declared a local emergency because of a mudslide. The mudslide caused a duplex to slide down a hill into another house after all of that rain we had.
Mm.
Both houses were destroyed, 25 people evacuated, and one woman was injured.
Mm-hmm. So with all this rain, does this mean that drought is finally over? Our water problems are over?
Not necessarily. First of all, the vast majority of rainwater in cities flows right into storm drains and goes to the ocean. So we still don't have a good way of capturing that rainwater.
Uh-huh.
And if you look at a drought map, online, the one from February 14th, so just last week, shows most of the state, except for the middle part where we are and the Sierras, is abnormally dry. Parts of Southern California are still in a moderate drought.
Hmm.
We depleted and overpumped our groundwater, the water under the ground in basins and aquifers, almost to completely zero during the drought. And it's going to take a lot of time to replenish those aquifers.
Mm-hmm.
All this snowfall will help once it melts, but that takes time too.
Right.
And regardless of all this rainfall, there are still a bunch of water conservation conflicts happening at the state level.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In his new term as governor, Gavin Newsom ousted the head of the State Water Resources Control Board, Felicia Marcus. She championed this controversial plan to reallocate more of the river flows to an endangered fish population. This was at the expense of agriculture and cities, which made a lot of farmers mad.
Uh-huh.
His replacement is Joaquin Esquivel, someone who may be more friendly toward farmers' interests. So we'll have to see what new conservation policies come forward with the new board.
And talking about agriculture, how's all this rain affecting agriculture?
Well, all the rain is great for replenishing groundwater, which we need to do since we depleted so much of it during the last drought.
Mm-hmm.
But the state and federal government determines how much water stays in the rivers or gets diverted for agriculture. So the state needs to say, okay, farmers, you can get more water.
Mm-hmm.
There have been some politicians that just wrote a letter to the government saying, it's rained so much, there's enough water for us and the environment, so please give the Central Valley more. So we'll have to see what eventually comes of that.
Okay, Angela, why not give us a weather forecast? Any rain in our immediate future?
A little bit, but we may not see much of it in Northern California. There's supposed to be some light rain today in some areas, but here in the Bay, we may not see any real rain for at least another week.
All right. Thanks, Angela.
Thank you.
Angela Johnston is our environment reporter. You can reach her at environment@klw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. San Francisco is a biodiversity hotspot, and its parks are home to more than 50 types of mammals. There are western gray squirrels and possum. Yep, that's a possum. And now the city named after the patron saint of animals is home to an apex predator. Coyotes roam around McLaren Park, Golden Gate Park, and they're commonly spotted in the Presidio. That's where KALW's Christina Loring went a few years ago to find out what happens when wild coyotes come to urban neighborhoods.
Those are the cries of coyotes. That howling call and response was triggered by the Tuesday noon siren. The citywide alarm system is located right next to the coyotes' den. They were recorded by Damian Rafa, who works at the Presidio Trust.
It was as though we're hearing sort of this modern sound that's heard throughout the city on this routine basis, coupled with these ancient sounds of this place we now call San Francisco.
Hearing coyotes in San Francisco does seem sort of strange, more like Photoshop trickery or a blip in the ecology than a daily occurrence. But they were here first. The indigenous people of San Francisco, the Ohlone, say the coyote helped create the world. They thrived in the western U.S. until the late 1800s, when pioneers saw them as a threat to livestock. Then, after decades of being poisoned and trapped, coyotes were virtually wiped out. The last one on record in San Francisco was back in 1925. That is, until they made their triumphant return around 2001. Rafa says, by capturing and testing some, the Presidio Trust discovered that the coyotes had come from the north.
Which gave us the impression that the Golden Gate Bridge had functioned as a wildlife corridor, and that at some point, a little over a decade ago, several coyotes came over of different genders and since then have repopulated the city.
Now, San Francisco is known for an influx of transient people, but how would it support these new visitors? Rafa says, actually, it's practically made for them.
The Presidio was large enough, it had enough habitat to support two pairs of coyotes. So we're about 2.5 square miles. So that's roughly 1 square mile per pair. But we've gotten sightings throughout the park. But during breeding season, coyotes typically select more densely vegetated areas that are away from other canines, which is to say dogs, which are ubiquitous in the Presidio.
Fact. Presidio resident Charmin Bach takes her dogs out for walks on the winding trails near Mountain Lake Park.
I remember running through the Presidio once and seeing like a, you know, be careful of coyote sign, which kind of flipped me out a little bit. But I'm watchful of them because they're here.
Coyotes are dangerous.
That's Richard B. He's a rec and park worker I find near the Presidio's Julius Kahn playground.
If a coyote feels threatened, then they might attack. Whether a person come at them threatening or not, who knows how the coyote feel. You know, it's like, hey, you get a little bit too close to me and I might, you know, I might do something to you. So back up a little bit.
In 2007, two coyotes attacked a dog in Golden Gate Park. The dog's owner demanded that something be done, so federal authorities came in to shoot the coyotes. And then...
a few months later, people found a den with dead pups.
Jonathan Young, a wildlife ecologist with the Presidio Trust, says it got complicated.
What turns out happened was the dog was off-leash, and they were in a denning area, and the parents came out to protect their den, and they were killed by management. And the pups, you know, didn't have parents, so they starved. Mm-hmm. So that kind of sparked a controversy.
It inspired Animal Care and Control to work on a coexistence strategy. They started putting up the signs warning people of den sites, advising them not to feed coyotes and to keep dogs safely on a leash. But that's about it. It's illegal to remove coyotes in San Francisco under California state law, so they have no plans to change the status quo. They also don't know how many coyotes there are in the city now, but that's not good enough for Jonathan Young.
So I have here two motion sensor cameras that are infrared. So they basically just sit and they're on sort of a standby for 24/7. And anytime some motion goes in front of it, it triggers.
Young is grabbing cameras from his office in the Presidio. He can't track and capture every coyote or get a radio collar onto everyone, but he can take their picture.
If there's, say, there's more than one coyote and they're moving forward, you'll be able to capture all of those individuals.
It's breeding season now, so Young's plan is to set up cameras in what he believes are active den sites. We head outside and climb into his truck.
So I figure we could probably go by the golf course right now.
Okay.
And from there we can then go to Lobos Valley.
Oh, yeah. Perfect.
There's been a lot of activity in Lobos Valley.
It's barely dawn and the grass is still dewy. We head through the bucolic Presidio toward a spot where lots of coyotes can be heard at night.
Check. Is that someone's dog or is that a coyote? Mm-hmm.
We hop out of the truck to find a den spot or some evidence of where a coyote's route may be.
See that?
Uh-huh.
Looks like coyote fur.
Oh.
Yeah. That's another telltale sign when you find trails, especially because there's a lot of blackberry around here. So if you look for, it just pulls out chunks of their hair. So let's see, good spot for a camera trap. So anything that's coming down is going to be going right through this area.
Okay. So now that our camera trap is set up, we wait for weeks. Young keeps setting up cameras, but all he gets are images of raccoons. Finally, he gets a shot of what looks like a pregnant coyote. He'll put up signs to let the public know and reroute hiking trails if they dip into that hot spot or any others he discovers. More coyotes are on their way. A new batch of pups promises to make a very vocal appearance this spring. In San Francisco, I'm Christina Loring for Cross Currents.
If you've got something you would love to hear us report on, connect with us on Facebook and Twitter at Cross Currents FM. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Now, we're not going to stray far from parks and nature. Our next piece comes from our project, Hey Area, where you ask the questions and we set out to find answers. We're going to hear a couple coming up, and they're all reported by fellows in our Audio Academy training program. First, listener Ruta Iono wanted to know, why are there so many eucalyptus trees in the Bay Area? KALW's Kevin McLean went to find out.
So the eucalyptus trees are here because early settlers brought them from Australia. Apparently, those people weren't fans of the knobby oaks and shrubs they saw on parts of the California coast. They thought some tall trees would improve the landscape, and yeah, they thrived and looked nice, but the wood splintered easily and wasn't very good for lumber. So the Bay Area eucalypts grew into the towering groves we have today. For a more personal take, I went to find another Australian transplant.
My name is Natalie Nagalingam. I'm a curator of botany at the California Academy of Sciences.
Okay, I'm obviously taking shameless advantage of Natalie's accent. Anyway, she's not a eucalyptus specialist. The plants she studies actually grow underneath the trees on the forest floor.
In Australia, it's just like teeming with all these different species.
But since eucalypts aren't part of the Bay Area's native ecosystem, some think they should be removed. Others say they're part of the modern landscape and should stay. But that's not really what the question was about, so let's move on. While reporting this story, a few condescending people asked me why we can't just bring a bunch of koalas in to solve our little eucalyptus problem. But koalas aren't locusts. They have a very slow metabolism and are famously picky eaters, so no matter how adorable an invasion of them would be, they're never going to have the energy to mow down our eucalyptus trees. So stop asking. From a eucalyptus grove in San Francisco, I'm Kevin McLean for Cross Currents.
Thanks, Kevin. So let's hear another one. Listener Katie Taylor wanted to know,
why are there so many sand dollars on Ocean Beach? Are they doing okay, or have we poisoned the ocean and we're killing them off?
KALW's Priya Mahadevan took that one.
Sometimes if you walk along Ocean Beach, it'll be littered with sand dollars. They're actually flat sea urchins, and here they're white, because they're skeletons.
They are all dead. All of the sand dollars that wash up here are dead or very nearly so.
That's Rich Moy, a curator of invertebrate zoology at the California Academy of Sciences. He says that here at Ocean Beach, we have millions of sand dollars living offshore.
Well, here we have a kind of perfect storm of conditions.
Our currents bring in lots of food for sand dollars. They live for roughly a decade, and after that, they die and dislodge from the bottom of the ocean. The strong surf pulls them inland, and our smooth shoreline helps keep them fully intact as they wash up.
And so you can actually see them in huge numbers on the beach here because it's a gentle place for dead sand dollars to go find their final resting place.
These creatures can tell us a lot about the state of the ocean. The insides of their bodies are exposed to seawater, so they're sensitive to small changes in the ocean's chemistry. Moy says that for now, Ocean Beach sand dollars seem healthy.
I think they're doing fine at the moment, yes.
Later, I meet our question asker, Katie Taylor, on Ocean Beach to give her the good news.
You seem very concerned about sand dollar health.
Yes, I am.
As it turns out, they're doing fine.
They are?
Yeah.
Oh, that's so good.
So when you see all those beautiful sand dollars, you can enjoy them knowing it's all part of a healthy life cycle. At Ocean Beach, I'm Priya Mahadevan for Hey Area.
Thanks, Priya. All right, one more. Listener Lakoya Lejeune wanted to know this.
When and why did the drum circle start in Lake Merritt?
We sent KLW's Joanne DeLuna to find out the answer.
There's no set start time. Drummers know to just show up at the Lake Merritt pergola every Saturday and Sunday afternoon. The sound of one drummer can grow into a synchronized heartbeat of up to 50 drummers at its peak. When I asked about the circle's origin, no drummer knew for sure, until I spoke with longstanding member Carrie Taylor.
In the summer of 2012, when it very first started.
The circle is an offshoot of the one at Ashby BART station in Berkeley. That one is said to have originated at UC Berkeley more than 30 years ago.
We kind of wanted to have a more open space and welcome more of the community in.
Drumming at the lake wasn't always harmonious. In September 2015, a resident claimed the musicians were drumming illegally and called the cops. But an ordinance allows musicians to play during park hours, as long as they're not mic'd.
We were following the guidelines.
So groups around the bay united on the steps of Oakland City Hall to drum in protest and establish the right to be there. Kerry says this circle is about more than just drumming.
I'm finding we're there for each other, and that's really cool. You don't see that very often.
And he says anybody's welcome to join.
We'll do little things like teach them how to place their hands on the drum. And now you're on your own. You fly. Go ahead, fly with it.
From the pergola at Lake Merritt, I'm Joanne DeLuna for Hey Area.
Thanks, Joanne. Those were the first stories our fellows made with us. So if you'd like to do that kind of thing too, we're currently accepting applications for our summer journalism training program, where you get to hone your audio storytelling skills with us in our newsroom right here at KALW. You'll get to do good work and you'll get to have a great time. We have dance parties and chocolate. We hope you'll apply. Find more information at KALW.org. Tune into Cross Currents tomorrow at 5. We'll take a close look at one of the most meaningful works of art in the Bay Area.
It's a mural of dualities. At the very top, you have the ancient world. And over here, you have modernity, the modern world.
The story behind the Pan-American Unity Mural by Diego Rivera and the woman whose job it is to tell its tale tomorrow at 5. This music is by experimental guitarist Bill Orcutt from San Francisco. He's playing at the Ivy Room in Albany tomorrow night. Today's Cross Currents team includes Janae Darden, Sarah Nora Coast, Magnolia McKay, Lisa Morehouse, Marissa Ortega-Welch, True Quinn, and Eli Wirtschafter. Our engineers are James Rollins, Tadek Foda, and Gabe Graben. Content manager is Shirin Adil. Our managing editor is David Boyer. Deputy news director is Angela Johnston. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.